Hi, I'm Malcolm Hawker, and this is the CDO Matters podcast, the show where I dig deep into the strategic insights, best practices, and practical recommendations that modern data leaders need to help their organizations become truly data-driven. Tune in for thought-provoking discussions with data, IT, and business leaders to learn about the CDO matters that are top of mind for today's chief data officers. Hello, Data Universe. I am Malcolm Hawker. I'm the host of the CDO Matters podcast. I am so happy you could be joining us today, maybe through your podcast provider of choice, the Spotify's, Google's, Apple's of the world. Maybe you're checking us out on YouTube and you're seeing my incredibly disappointing video quality of my camera. It seems to be going a little awry these days. I don't know why. Or perhaps it's compression. I won't ruminate on that. Thank you for joining us today. I'm really happy to be joined by Robert Hawker. Robert is going to be talking today about practical data quality. He wrote a book on it. It's right. And I'm holding up a book for everybody on podcasts, but I'm doing it in a way that I made a LinkedIn post about this as well, and it was pretty much that exact look. I really enjoyed the book. I read it maybe about 6 months ago, 7 months ago. When did it come out, Robert?
It came out September 23. So yeah, coming up to 6 months now.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And I had maybe a sneak peek copy, maybe a pre-print copy. I don't know. But we're going to talk about data quality today because it's something that we all talk about and everybody cares about and everybody's got an opinion on it. But I'll be brutally honest and say that I'm not entirely sure people really kind of have their hands around it. And it's something that should be near and dear to all data leaders. So we're going to talk about that. Before we get into it, let's address the elephant in the room, and it's not AI. There's not a lot of hawkers in the world, and you got two of them on one podcast. Which is a little crazy. Now, my family, at least on the Hawker side, most certainly traces itself back to the UK. You are in the UK, yes, sir?
Correct. Yeah, I live in Reading, which is a little bit west of London.
You're like the fourth person I've spoken to in the last few days that is from Reading. We just hired somebody, Prophecy, from Reading. I'm working with this guy named Avanad, and then Jed, who is from Reading. I don't know why. All things keep pointing back to Reading these days.
Cool.
I mean, is that a common name in the UK? Do you see, like, when you were going to like school, are there other hawkers that are getting?
No. I've never come across another hawker at school. There's a lot of Hawkins in the UK, but not many Hawker surnames. Cool. But I think I said to you before, in the UK, you get signs everywhere. I think you get it all around the world, but signs saying no hawkers. And I used to get people at school taking that very literally. In our local shopping centre, we had the no hawkers sign, and if they spotted me in there, they'd be looking to chase me out as quickly as they could.
So sad.
Yes.
I'm sorry you had to deal with that because you know, it's our name. What are we going to do? It's not like, well, I guess we could change it. But so the funny thing is, growing up, I used to think that's what our name meant, right? Like I used to, like Baker, they bake things. Smith, they make horseshoes, right? Like I thought Hawker was the person that was like peddling stuff on the street, right?
Yeah.
And at least according to my aunt, or aunt as we say often here in the US, she seems to think that we come from a line of people that are like, you know, harriers, that are like do falconry.
Okay.
Have you ever heard anything like that?
No, I always used had the term in my head of, you know, traveling salesman. And I've always thought it's that, but I'm much happier to go with your aunt's interpretation. But let's go with that from now on.
That's exactly right. We come from a long line of people who use birds to kill things for us.
Yes.
I'm okay with that.
We'll go with that. It seems
a little more regal, but I mean, in all of my travels to the UK, I don't think there's any hawkers buried in Westminster Abbey.
I don't think so, Malcolm. No.
Right? Like sure. It's not like we come from the gentry for
no,
sure.
No.
Right? Yeah, maybe we're gentry. No. If we were the hawk people, like, you know, maybe we knew the gentry, but I'm pretty sure we're not part of that class.
If there's any gentry in my ancestry, it comes from a female line, definitely not from that male hawker line, but there you go.
Well, ditto. So I got my name. Here we go. Our guests are kind of like, you know, our subscribers are like, what are these crazy people talking about? we will talk about data. But fun fact, my name came from a name from Scottish kings. So okay. There were actually three Scottish kings named Malcolm. One of them has had a nickname of Big Head.
Yeah.
Which in Gaelic is Cianmore, Big Head. And yeah. The place I was married, interestingly enough, in Canada is a place called Canmore, which was named for King Malcolm Big Head. There you go.
Brilliant. Well, I'll tell you what, if we're going to talk about where Christian names come from, I have a silly story there as well. So we had a dog before I was born. There was a dog called Robbie in the house, and I'm called Robert, and my mum has always called me Robbie. So I'm pretty sure I was named after the dog. So like Indiana Jones.
All right. So from such humble beginnings, that our podcast listeners and our YouTube viewers get to be given insights and experts and expertise and knowledge from somebody named after a dog and somebody named after a Scottish king with a giant head. So let's do
fantastic.
It.
Let's do
All
it.
All right. What I know this is a loaded question, but it has to be asked because it was the title of the book. What in your mind, what does practical data quality mean? Sounds good to me. Put it on paper for us.
Well, I like to say that I'm a very practical person. First of all, I'm not someone that's going to do something theoretical for you. I get my hands dirty. I get involved and I deliver things. That's just who I am. And I think I wanted my book to be like that as well. So what you find throughout the book is it's filled with real life examples from various places that I've worked. So every single concept that I put into the book, I tried to very quickly then bring a real life example to that where you could see how you'd apply that concept. So there's there are templates that come with the book. There you can see actual reports that I've used in the past for showing monitoring of data quality. So I tried to just keep it incredibly practical and usable all the way through. So that's where the title comes from.
I like that, and I really enjoyed the real world stories that you shared in the book, because I think for many, data quality is far too theoretical and conceptual. Right? It's kind of like world peace, right? Like nobody's going to argue against world peace, and nobody's going to argue against data quality. That sounds good. I want more of that.
Definitely.
But I think some of the challenges we have is like, what does that actually really mean?
Yeah.
So when it comes to implementing a data quality program, I'm a CDO. Maybe I have one, maybe I'm inheriting one, or maybe I'm thinking about getting one off the ground. What are the few things that I really need to be thinking about in order to take more of that practical approach?
Definitely. I mean, before I answer that, I'll just say one more thing about practical here, because actually, I think of all the areas of data management, data quality is one of the most practical, because you can very quickly just identify a set of rules that you know your data should comply with. And then you can very quickly, with any tool like Excel, even if you want to, measure how much of your data actually complies with that rule and how much of your data doesn't comply with that rule. And then straight away, you can give a score to your data. So it's very real, very quickly. And then you can improve on that score very quickly as well and show tangible results that you can link back to some sort of business success, right? So it just is a very practical part of data management, you know. Whereas if you think about elements of data governance, where you're appointing data stewards and you're trying to get them to change the culture in their part of the organization, that's really, really important as well. But it doesn't yield the practical measurable results that data quality does. So that's another reason for the name practical, I guess. But coming back to your question, what do CDOs need to know and think about data quality? So I think the first thing that a CDO would need to assist their teams with on data quality is coming up with a compelling business case. And this is a really tough area, because actually you don't know the whole point of data quality measurement is that you want to find out how much of your data is good and how much of your data is bad. And so at the beginning of that, you know you're going to need to spend some money to do that, but you don't actually know what the benefits are going to be up front, because you don't know the extent of the problem. So, you know, coming up with that compelling business case when you're up against a project you're usually up against a range of other projects that want investment as well. And those projects have got, we'll be able to reduce the number of FTEs in this area by X, and that comes with a value of Y. And, you know, it's very tangible, measurable stuff. Whereas with data quality, when you just don't know the extent of the problem yet, it's really hard to do that. So we can talk a bit more about that later, but that's one of the key things a CDO needs to be supporting the team with. Then I think the next one is just tying into business strategy, because, you know, you can take any set of data and you can profile it and look for issues. Hey, that field's only got 20% of data in it. That field's got a huge variation of field lengths, all that kind of stuff. You can pick holes in any set of data that you want to, right? And then you can go and fix those holes. But actually, unless you've aligned to your business strategy, you could be burning time on things that don't matter. So, you know, a big part of this work that the senior leader needs to help with is understanding what will really shift the dial for the organization you're working in, and how to link that to the data itself, and focus only on fixing the things that need to be fixed to drive value for that business strategy. So, for example, if you've got a business that's trying to shift its customer base from direct end users to wholesalers or something like that, then you need to be, there's no point spending tons of time fixing the end user customer data quality, millions and millions of records. The ones you really need to get right are the wholesalers and all their locations. So that kind of thing is very important. And you sometimes, as a senior leader, you find that your teams on the ground are disconnected from that strategy, and they're running around fixing stuff that doesn't necessarily need to be fixed. I think the next one I would mention would be data quality cannot just be a one-off exercise. So many times I've come across organizations that are trying to bring in consultants for a fixed period of time to clean up the data. Yeah. When I first became a leader in data, actually, my predecessor was about to employ an organization, large consulting organization with an offshore team, who were just going to take a look at our supplier data and fix it. That was without talking to anyone within the organization to understand what was really important within that supplier data. And you know, I'm sure they would have made improvements. They would have found VAT numbers and company IDs and things like that, but they wouldn't have found the things that really mattered to the organization. At the time, the organization was trying to work on spend analysis and understand how much money was being spent with certain groups of suppliers. So what they really needed was vendor parentage hierarchy information. So, you know, I'm sure that the third party wouldn't have focused on that. So it can't just be solved by throwing money at it for a short term period, bringing consultants in and fixing the problems. It has to be embedded in the organization, and it needs to be repeated over time, and you need to be constantly monitoring it. It doesn't stay fixed, basically. And then a couple more things. So I actually think that for a CDO starting a new data organization, data quality work can be a really great place to start, because it does deliver those tangible results. Obviously, it's easier if you've already got a data governance initiative up and running, because you've got data stewards, you've probably got data definitions telling you what good looks like for your data, things like that. But if you don't have any of that up and running, the quickest way you can deliver value, I think, is to start to identify the key things that are wrong with the data, linking that again back to the strategy, providing some quick wins. So, I mean, I fell into that discovery at an organization that I joined. I joined an organization to start the data team from scratch. And when I joined, it was easy, actually, from a certain perspective, because I was pushing on open doors. I'd been used to trying to persuade people to get excited about data quality, but the quality was so bad in this organization that they were desperate for somebody to come in and do something about it. So I was straight away monthly going to the board to report on data quality. And actually, it was very easy to move the dial for them quickly, because they could, again, back to being practical, you see the tangible results and you make a difference, and they can see that improvement in the numbers. So I do think that's a great place to start. And I think those are the main things I would say for the time being.
So to summarize, yeah, you need to focus on outcomes. Number two, you need to align to a business strategy Avoid random acts of data quality. But we can talk about this some more because there's plenty of random acts of data quality happening out there. Number three is it's a program. It's not a project. And number four is it's a great place to start. It's a great, it's a natural kind of prioritization thing, or way to prioritize, way to galvanize the organization around making improvements to your data management.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So let's press on the, we'll press on all of them, but let's press on the first one first. The first one first. Let's press on number one. And what I heard you say, I'm paraphrasing you now, is that you will be able to establish benchmarks of what good looks like, and you'll be able to measure against those. And you could be able to maybe put together some metrics that estimate what the impacts of that would be, at least, at least on the data side of the house. An example would be, you have something that consistently breaks data pipelines, and if you didn't break the data pipeline anymore, you'd be able to do ABC or something else. Or you have, some companies are still sending snail mail. I actually had a conversation with a company last week that is still sending like Royal Mail snail mail.
Wow.
Maybe your return rates are 10% and that costs you a certain amount of money based on local, but you can come up with some estimates. But what I did hear you say though, is that it's going to be really difficult, at least in the short term, to come up with very robust metrics of what the improvements are going to drive from a business outcome perspective.
Yes.
Did I paraphrase you correctly?
Yeah, 100%. Let me try and give an example. So one organization that I work for was really struggling with a huge number of queries coming in from suppliers. So the suppliers were questioning money that they'd received in their bank accounts, because they were not receiving remittance advices. So the remittance advice provides you with a breakdown of, hey, I've just sent you $10,000, and that $10,000 goes across these three invoices that you sent. And they can then allocate it in their systems and close all the invoices down. But the company that I was working for was struggling with the data quality. And one of the things it didn't have was the correct remittance advice email address details. So most suppliers weren't receiving a remittance advice. And they were then coming to the accounts payable team and asking them, what's this money for? Which invoices that get allocated? And the number of queries coming in far exceeded the capacity of the team to deliver it. Now, you know, you could count the number of queries that you were getting, and you could count eventually the number of suppliers that were missing the email addresses, and then you could fix those email addresses and create some kind of estimate of how much the queries were going to drop by, and then you could try and come up with a cost per query, and then turn that into an FTE number. That's a real example of how you'd come up with a business case. But remember, in a data quality program, you're usually talking about hundreds of rules, hundreds of things that need to be right in the data. And so that estimate I've just roughly outlined would probably take a few hours to think about and validate and get all the assumptions in place. And you've got to multiply that few hours by, say, 300 rules that you want to develop. And you've got to come up with clever ways of estimating how much the benefit is going to be of each of those 300 rules. It's just not economical to do. You could spend just as long coming up with the estimates of the benefits as you could actually resolving the data problem if you're not careful. So the challenge is you're going in and you're saying, I need to spend some money to build a data quality program, but I can't really tell you completely what those benefits are going to be yet. I can give you some examples of what the benefits will be. I can pick on five rules, tell you precisely what those benefits will be, but you're going to have to take my word for it that the other 295 rules are going to add some kind of equivalent value, you know. So I do spend quite a bit of time in my book talking about how to make that compelling, that case.
You just touched on it, which is, to me, in my experience, having been in these positions before, the one or the two cases that are like the glaring, in this case, you're causing a lot of headaches to your suppliers, unhappy suppliers, right?
Yeah.
souring those relationships. But in that one case, or the case I gave, the snail mail, right? Maybe sounds antiquated, but it's still true. It still happens. But there's in any given company, I would argue there's probably tens, if not hundreds, of major, well-known, relatively high profile, where the one thing where you could come up with some estimate, where that one thing in and of itself could justify pretty significant investments in data quality. Do you agree?
I do. I completely agree. And I mean, I always think of three different approaches to this. So number one is you cherry pick those rules where you know there's a lot of value. You calculate the business case for those rules specifically. And usually you can deliver enough benefit that you can justify the investment. You can get to a point where the rate of return is high enough just from a handful of those rules, and treat the other rules then as a bonus, if you like. The second approach you can take is to calculate again for a handful of rules and extrapolate across the others. So you can say, well, we think we're going to deliver $50,000 of benefit for these three rules. So if we're going to deliver 300, we can times that by 100. But you don't be as simplistic as that. You would say, for us to pay for the project, we would only need the other 297 rules to deliver a further 50K of benefit. So you say, I guarantee you 50K of benefit. And we think there's a lot more than 50K in these 297. But even if there isn't, even if there's only 50K, you still get your money back. You know, that's the second approach, that extrapolation approach. Yeah. And the third approach is to go top down. So you start looking at benchmarks. So you can go to organizations like Hackett, for example, and you can say, organizations typically in my sector are able to do supplier management with a team of three FTEs for my size of company and my industry and all those kinds of things. We've currently got 15 FTEs. So, and we attribute five FTEs of that problem to data being an issue. So we believe we can move towards that benchmark and that will save us this amount of money. That's, you know, a third way of doing it. And I think it really depends on the culture of your organization as to which of those is going to work best.
That's great advice. And something I would say and really stress to our listeners and viewers, one of the things that I really enjoyed the most about Robert's book, not the fact that it was written by a hawker, I do enjoy that. One of the things that I really enjoyed the most is that a lot of these stories, a lot of the narratives, a lot of the kind of the anecdotes that you use always tie back to what I would call operational uses of data. And I think we have a little bit of a problem in the data and analytics world where so many people align data quality issues to analytical problems. And don't get me wrong, having reports that are incorrect is a problem, right? Yeah. Having incorrect reports, giving data to your CEO that is patently wrong is a problem. But I think that in many ways, talking about data quality, especially using a very broad definition of it in the analytics world, can often lead to really academic undertakings and academic conversations that really maybe don't have anything to do with data quality at all.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example, and I'd love your perspective on this. There have been multiple sound bites published over the years talking about how much time data scientists lose mm-hmm. to data quality issues.
Yeah.
And when you peel that onion, what you find is that what the data scientists are doing is what I would call data wrangling.
Yeah.
Right, they're creating pipelines, they're creating ETL processes, they're transforming data, they're normalizing data to get it in a form where it can be used to build models or can be consumed by a Python script or something. But it has to go from being optimized for operational use to optimized for an analytical use. And I fundamentally disagree that that's a data quality process. What would be your response to that?
I would agree with you completely. I think that is just a natural consequence of having multiple different data sets that you need to bring together to get the result that you want. So the data in each individual system can be perfect from that system's perspective. But when you start to bring the systems together, then it becomes a problem. So again, to give a real example of exactly this, a manufacturing organization that I worked for had an SAP system where everything was driven by batch number. So, you know, this particular batch has gone through these processes on these dates and things like that. And we managed to get the yield of X, you know, coming from SAP. But the manufacturing system had all the really interesting data in it that you could use in multivariate analysis, for example, to see what was going on and what was driving yield. So things like temperatures in every space in the manufacturing site, humidity, all of those kinds of things were very important to the process. And that manufacturing system didn't have the batch number from SAP. There was no way of tying together the manufacturing data and the batch data in SAP from the two different systems. You could only tie it together using dates and times. So you could say, we've got these readings between this date and time and this date and time, and that seems to tie roughly to what was in SAP for that batch at that date and time and that date and time. And you could tie the two things together that way, and data scientists were doing that. But again, there was nothing wrong with the data in the manufacturing system. There was nothing wrong with the data in the SAP system. They needed wrangling to get them together. So that's a fortuitous example that fits exactly what you were saying there, definitely.
I've had interesting conversations with people online who vehemently argue that data quality is both a noun and a verb.
Okay.
Meaning it's a state of data and it's also a process. And it's true that it is both.
Yeah.
Right. Data quality is a discipline. It could be a process. But in the case of the use case that I just described, I just don't think, to your point, if the data is perfectly fit for purpose in the operational system, and we in the data world have to do something to it to make it easily consumable in an analytical world, I think that's just the way it is. I don't think that's a data quality issue, but that's just me.
No, but I think actually, interestingly, you're making me think now, it does then fall within my definition of bad data in my book. So the way I define bad data in my book is I say that basically data is kept in an organization. You only bring data into an organization for kind of four purposes, really. One is to run your processes. Two is to make good decisions. Three is to enable you to be compliant with laws and regulations. And four is to actually sometimes use data as a product or a revenue stream. That's not applicable to every organization, but it's becoming more and more applicable. I mean, very quick example on this. One of my previous organizations started to take the data from their customers of stock levels of their product, and they started to manage the inventory and the stock from their customers as a service. And it made them quite sticky. Exactly. They're combining the real product, the physical product, with a data product, and they're making themselves quite sticky then as a supplier for those companies, because it's quite hard then if you give that service up, you're buying a different product and you suddenly need to manage all your inventory again. So for me, my definition of bad data, coming back to my point, was if the data is intended for one of those four purposes and it doesn't meet one of those four purposes, then it's bad data. So actually my example of the SAP system and the manufacturing system, it has become bad data, because from a system silo perspective, it's okay. But when you actually bring it together for the purpose that it's intended for, it's not meeting that purpose. So it is, from my definition, bad data. But then it's not actually correcting the data in the operational system. It's adding an enhancement to that operational system. So the enhancement in this case would be to add a batch number field into that manufacturing system, so that whenever a particular batch was running through a process, you're tying the humidity and the temperature to that batch at that time. And then I think, so for me, it's a really interesting one. I've accidentally flip-flopped between the two. But there you go.
We won't tell your publisher. Oh, well, you're consistent with your book. It's good. It's fine. But I mean, I think it's okay. Because we in the data world, we're librarians, right? We need to label everything. We need to define everything. We need to classify everything. It's just how our brains work in the data world. Yeah. And that's okay. I think the problem arises was when we start complaining about it to the business.
Yes.
100%. I think that's when the problem arises, because the business is like, hey, what the heck?
Yeah.
Everything's working here. I'm hitting my SLAs. We're pushing product on time. We're exceeding customer expectations. And you're telling me my data is bad.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is another thing I can't say enough about in the book. It's you have to make that link between the data producers. So this is my name for the people that actually put data into systems, you know. So it could be, in my old world, it's the manufacturing staff who are putting the data in about that batch and what's going on with that batch. They're data producers. They're producing data in that SAP system or whatever. And then you've got the data consumers. So the people that use reports, the people that benefit from those processes, the people that work with the regulator, all that kind of stuff, they are consuming the data. And the data stewards and owners need to bring those two groups together, the producers and the consumers, and they need to educate the producers on what is important for everyone that consumes that data. And so, in, you know, going back to our example, those data producers would need to understand we're going to enhance that manufacturing system to include the batch number, and they must include the batch number in every time they run a process in that manufacturing world. You know, that's that if you don't tell them, then of course they're going to hold their hands up and say, well, you know, I'm doing everything you've ever told me to do, and you're still saying mm-hmm. the data's bad. It's all about that communication, facilitating that.
Indeed. So getting back to the four things that CDOs need to know about data quality and to kind of focus on, your number two was, and I'm, this is my phrase, not yours, but it's avoiding the random acts of data quality. I think that one to me makes sense, right? Because in top three deliverable for any CDO, generally in the top three, number one is almost always going to be data strategy. And if you've got a data strategy, you know what's important. The data strategy is aligned to the business strategy. You've got your top five things that you need to execute against. And if one of them is better customer or improving your customer relationships, then maybe focusing on your employee data or doing an employee data cleanup just doesn't align to your strategy, then don't bother doing it. I think that's basically what you're saying.
Yes.
Your number three about a program. Let's talk about that more, because and I already know the answer here, but I think I already know the answer here. Which annoys my wife because I almost always think I know the answer. But I'd love your perspective. When I was at Gartner, you know, data quality and MDM were kind of going at it, you know, neck and neck for the award for the program that loses steam most often.
Yes.
Right. Like the one and done. You know, we did MDM and then we lost our funding, or we did data quality and then we lost our funding. To a CDO that may be facing that or concerned about that, what would you say?
Interesting question. I mean, I think first thing, I've been an MDM person as well. So, you know, I implemented SAP NetWeaver MDM, which is an older product.
Long lost brothers. Yeah. This is awesome. Keep it coming.
And then implemented MDG as well, which is SAP's more recent product. You know, we created centralized processes for creating catalogs of product data, and we brought down some of the SLAs for that for kind of 30 days, all the way down to kind of a few hours, things like that. So we, you know, I've been there and done it with MDM. I think for me, over time, the business case for MDM has become a little bit less easy to get across the line. So especially if you think about customer and vendor in particular, those were traditional areas where you do a lot of MDM work. And I think, you know, when I first started in this area, you were typically using spreadsheets. You know, you'd get a supplier to fill out a spreadsheet, you'd send out that data to your procurement teams and the finance teams and your master data teams and get everybody to approve and contribute and things like that. But these days you've got, you know, supplier portals online where the supplier will provide their details and then an automated workflow kicks off and collects all the information you need, and then eventually APIs will post it into your ERP system or something like that. And the role of MDM gets a bit lost in that process. I mean, it can still be really important for consolidating and harmonizing data, but the kind of central MDM process is less tangible these days. And I found it really hard to get that off the ground when I was leading a data and analytics team. I think coming back to the real question, how do we avoid losing our data quality initiatives? Exactly. I think it's starting small, first of all. So just picking that really fundamentally important area. So, you know, when I joined the business I talked about before, suppliers were actually pulling the plug on arrangements with that organization. We even had a risk of the electricity going off in a manufacturing site, which would have been absolutely horrendous. So the board had their eyes firmly on that issue. So clearly, we just needed to sort out supplier data in, you know, a very short period of time and move the needle. And to be honest, just by achieving that, we then gained ourselves a great deal of grace for a long period of time to invest in making that sustainable and building other data types into it. So I think start small, deliver quickly is an obvious piece of advice. I think the next piece of advice is to produce really tangible numbers on your data quality as quickly as you can. So be able to say, look, we are getting a score of X percent on our product master data at the moment based on these rules. And we've shifted that from X percent to Y percent. And that means this for the business. Here's some of the wins we've achieved this period. You know, those are the things that sustain your data quality program. I think the other part of it is thinking ahead. You know, quite often the program focuses on that first critical issue, and you've got all your staff all aligned and you've got people really working well as a team, and then that initiative ends and there's a gap, and then you have to start all over again and get the teams back on and get everyone interested again. So it's like keeping that consistent push going and planning ahead and making sure you've got the next area in the next area gradually interested. So
love it.
Yeah.
So what I hear you say, start small.
Yeah.
Deliver value in bite-sized increments. Celebrate your successes. So it's something that I heard you say, like shout it from the mountaintops. Put something over the water cooler, make a t-shirt, whatever it is, but shout it from the mountaintop.
Better still, get the business folks who you helped to shout for you. I think
I love that. Yeah.
I'm not the greatest at shouting about my own successes, to be honest. I prefer to get someone else to do it for me. And if it's the business person you helped, it's just so much more authentic, you know?
Yep. And do that, wash, rinse, and repeat, and just keep doing it over and over. I love that advice. That is very, very sage advice.
Thank you.
However, I'm playing devil's advocate here.
It's allowed. No problem.
Okay. But I did hear you say earlier that, you know, a big part of this is defining rules, right? How do I define data quality rules, right? How do I know when something is accurate? That sounds like governance to me. And so what you're saying is that I've got to define my governance framework before I can start on data quality. Or is there a different way? Because no, to me, data governance sounds hard, and that sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, I think that ideally, it's easier for you in a data quality program if somebody has defined data definitions. So the definition is the description of what a particular field or fields is for in your records. And usually when you define a data field, you include a little bit about what good looks like. You know, you say this field typically should contain X. And that helps, that gets you halfway there. And that's really helpful. But again, when I joined the organization I talked about earlier as the first employee in data and analytics and establishing it from scratch, we didn't have any of that. And we started first with data quality. And that did mean we had to do some rule definitions as we went along, but it's not as hard as it sounds. I mean, you're basically looking at what is the business problem that we're trying to solve? What is the cause of that business problem? And it's usually a series of causes. It's always the, you know, small things chipping away at your success. And then you get yourself a spreadsheet list of all the fields that don't seem to be correct and seem to be causing problems. And then you say, well, what should be in that field then? If at the moment we're seeing that's empty 50% of the time, is that okay? And you speak to your business people that know that data and know what it does. And they'll say, no, that's not okay. That should be 100%. That field should be always containing numbers, and half the time it's got numbers and alpha characters in it. And, you know, very quickly you can derive a reasonable set of rules and start measuring the data against those rules. So it definitely helps if someone's come along and done that first, but you can do both in parallel and deliver. And then you're not just doing the kind of theoretical data governance stuff. You're doing theoretical data governance stuff at the same time you're delivering practical results and improving things with data quality.
Love it. I mean, what you said is figure out what problem you're trying to solve, and then define the rules needed to solve the problem.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
So exactly. I would call that an MVP, minimum viable product, or a minimum viable whatever is needed just to solve that problem. We are kind of prone to want to implement frameworks, right? And I heard this often when I was at Gartner. It's like, you know, do you have a good framework for data governance? And I was like, yeah, there's lots of them. We have one. Dhamma has a beautiful spinning wheel.
Yeah.
And that I think you quote actually in the book, or you make reference to the Dhamma wheel. And it's great. It's great. Yeah. But you don't have to figure everything out on the wheel. You just need to figure out what's needed to solve that problem. That is
correct.
That is wonderful advice.
Yeah.
All right. Our last question. Of course, we can't have a podcast these days without talking about AI.
No.
What do you see are the short-term benefits of AI, longer-term benefits of AI when it comes to data quality? And maybe if I'm a data quality professional, net, is AI a force for good or something I should be concerned about?
Okay. I've thought about this fairly long and hard, and I think that actually AI is going to be really valuable to data quality professionals. I think that one of the challenges of a data quality program is that those of us that instigate one are usually business focused people. I mean, my original career was accounting. I was a financial accountant. And so we tend to come from those business backgrounds and end up in data. And we don't tend to be coders and developers. What you always end up doing is you define those rules, and then you hire, often from a consultancy, a third party, people that can actually codify those rules into a data quality tool. And I think that AI is going to be built into all of those tools over time, so that you'll be able to write in natural language what your rule is and link it to certain fields in your data set. And then the AI will generate the code. So I'm not saying you won't need any developers anymore. Clearly, you're going to want developers to check over that code and make sure it's doing the right thing. I mean, these days I'm a Power BI geek, writing code regularly, and I use GPTs to help me generate code when I'm stuck, but I still need to understand that code well enough to know that I've done a good job. So there's still a role for those developers, but where your program might have had five developers, they'll probably be able to have one. And so going back to this really challenging business case that we talked about earlier, suddenly the business case becomes a lot more compelling because the costs go right down. So I think you'll be able to get that. You'll also be able to go the other way around. So when you've written a data quality rule that gets turned into code, you'll be able to then get something like AI to write a data definition, which will speed up your data governance program. So if you have started down the data quality path without doing data governance first, then I think you'll be able to retrofit some of the work you've done and get the benefits for data governance quite rapidly. So I can see plenty of benefits there. And I think also the other benefit really is a kind of a side benefit, but remember that your whole organization at the moment is thinking a little bit about how it can use AI to drive revenues, reduce costs. You know, every company is doing this right now. It's thinking, how can we jump on this bandwagon? And the one thing I've not heard as much consensus on data quality until now, really. Every organization is not just saying we want to do AI, but they're also saying, how are we going to be successful with AI when our data is so bad? Our data quality needs to be improved so we can get the best out of AI. So guess what? Suddenly a lot of doors have just opened for you data quality professionals, because people have recognized that they need the data quality to get to a level to get the real value from AI.
And I would argue, as long as we have functional distinctions in our organizations, as long as we have sales versus marketing versus procurement, versus isn't the right word, but sales, marketing, procurement, HR, finance, you name it, as long as those functional silos exist, there will be a need for something to resolve differences that naturally occur because those people speak different languages, they use different tools, they have different perspectives, different goals.
Yeah.
And that means job security for people who do MDM, who do data quality, who did data integration, everything that you just spoke to.
100%. Right. Couldn't agree more.
Cool. Yeah. All right, Robert, this has been awesome. I really enjoyed the conversation. I really love the focus on operational uses, real world examples of what does it mean to improve your data quality.
Thank you.
Practical Data Quality by my long lost brother, Robert Hawker. Please pick up your copy now. The publisher is PACT, P-A-C-K-T. Enjoy your evening, Robert. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was brilliant. Thanks.
Wonderful. And to our listeners, to our subscribers, to our growing CDO Matters community, thank you for tuning into another podcast. I truly hope you got value from this. I hope you will join us on another episode sometime very soon. Thanks all. Bye for now.